electrodes that tape to your forehead, beaming thoughts and emotions directly into your brain. After 20, 30, 40 years of living that way, how would you even remember that you're in a simulation? This is why it is so difficult for us to pull ourselves out of the movie for very long. If you think it's tough to run out of the movie theater to take a bathroom break, just try stopping the mind movie. In fact, just try being aware that you're watching a mind movie. Yet, being aware of this mind movie is the first step to mind hacking. We must learn to analyze the mind with all its amazing cinematography before we can hack it. Begin mind game. What was my mind just thinking? For the rest of the day, start building up awareness of your mind by asking yourself as frequently as possible, what was my mind just thinking? Keep track of how many times you remember to check in on your mind. At the end of the day, record your final score in the practice sheet. End mind game. A diet of the mind. The brilliant mathematician John Nash, who's the subject of the Hollywood movie A Beautiful Mind, as well as the book of the same name, is what the experts call really good at math. He won the 1994 Nobel Prize in Economics for his work in the field of strategic decision-making known as game theory, and his work is used today in everything from artificial intelligence to military strategy. Nash also suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. While his mental illness developed over many years, it was not until he was due to be promoted at MIT that his full-blown symptoms erupted. He told the head of a rival department that he would not be able to accept the position because, quote, "I am scheduled to become the Emperor of Antarctica," unquote. As his illness deepened, he spent time in and out of various mental institutions suffering from dreamlike delusional hypotheses such as being persecuted by the federal government, aliens trying to contact him through the New York Times, and the conviction that he was the Messiah. What happened next is even more remarkable. Without the aid of medication, he gradually retrained his thinking using what he called a diet of the mind. In other words, he was still tempted by the delusional patterns, but he intentionally rejected them. He describes it as an ongoing habit of choosing the right thoughts, more like a continuous process rather than waking up from a dream. This mastery of his mind, this ability to disengage from his own mental movie, led to tremendous career success later in life, including the John von Neumann Theory Prize, the Nobel Prize, and the 2001 Academy Award for Best Picture. He should get credit for that one, too. You are not your mind. This is easiest to observe during mental downtime, like driving or doing the dishes. When you're doing things that don't require a lot of concentration, your mind goes into overdrive, using those spare CPU cycles for projecting the movie. Sometimes the movie is a feel-good family comedy. Funny memories, pleasant thoughts, hopeful dreams. In these times, you see why the mind can be our best friend. Sometimes the movie is a depressing English period drama. Melancholy thoughts of despair, depression, or hopelessness, often involving tuberculosis. In these times, you see how our mind can be our worst enemy. Your mind spends most of its time projecting into the future, plans, dreams, fears, or reminiscing about the past, memories, regrets, nostalgia. Frequently, clips from the same movies play over and over. Why did I say that? I'm such an idiot. I don't know why I even try. I will never be able to do it. If I don't watch every penny, I'll end up in poverty. Does he really love me? Even though we've been together for so long, I'm still not sure. My kids are going to get injured, I just know it. Everyone at work is talking about me behind my back. I hate him. I hate him. I hate him. This funeral would be a lot more fun if I were high. We can all add our own mental movie clips to this list. It's difficult to reason with these kind of habitual thoughts. They seem to just appear from out of nowhere. That's the way the mind movie works. Later, we'll learn how to begin directing this movie. For now, just try to become aware that you're watching it. User versus superuser. Anyone who's spent time on a computer network has seen an error message like this.
You do not have sufficient privileges to perform that operation.
Which really means,
we don't trust you with this because we're afraid you'll screw something up.
In simple computer systems, everyone has access to everything. But quickly, this becomes unwieldy and dangerous. If you give a typical user access to the entire customer database, before you know it, he's accidentally erased 10 million names.
Sorry, I was just cleaning my keyboard.
It reduces problems if people have access only to what they need. Typically, the people who know what they're doing will maintain what we'll call super user access, making sure the ordinary users have limited power. You can't view everyone's email account, only your own, but super users can. You can't see everyone's files in the cloud, only your own, but super users can. This is why computer hackers always want to have super user access. We call this root access or rooting because you're at the root of the system. This is where the power is. Root in and everything is at your command. As a teenager, I used to attend a monthly computer club where dozens of computer enthusiasts would meet up to pirate thousands of dollars worth of computer software while eating Hostess Zingers. Ironically, this early version of the Pirate Bay was held in the basement of a church. This was long before the internet, so software was hard to find, and we would spend hours copying programs on 5 1/4 inch floppy disks until our drives would overheat, then we'd trudge home. One night, a stranger showed up. He said he was visiting from California, and he did look surprisingly tanned and fit, completely out of place among our pale, neck-bearded folk. He sidled over to me and asked, "What you got?" I went through my entire list of games. "Jumpman?"
"Got it."
"Mule?" I responded. "Space Taxi?" "Zork 1, Zork 2, Zork 3.
"Keep going."
"Zork 0?
"Anything else?"
It was crazy. No one had all those games.
"How about Pogo Joe?"
"Pogo Joe?"
He lit up.
"I'll take it."
As we were copying the game, he asked,
"You have Blue?"
"I've never heard of it."
"Check it out."
He pulled out a disc with a piece of masking tape across the top. One word was written on it. Blue. "What's that?" I asked.
"It lets you make free phone calls."
In the days before digital phone systems, the legendary Blue Box was a piece of hardware that simulated a tone made by the phone company's analog switching relays, allowing you to make long-distance phone calls for free. Before they invented Apple Computer, in fact, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak got their start building and selling Blue Boxes. One of Wozniak's original Blue Boxes is enshrined at the Computer History Museum. Blue was a software-only Blue Box. You called the phone company's information line, then held your phone receiver up to the computer speaker. Blue would blast out the magical 2600 hertz tone, putting you into super user mode. As it happened, I lived in Ohio and was dating a girl in Nebraska. And if that doesn't prove my geek cred, I don't know what does. Once I got Blue, I went insane with long distance phone calls. I was untouchable. I spent an entire month in blissful super user mode, calling her multiple times a day for free, until my dad got the phone bill.
$63 in information calls,
he screamed. I still remember him waving the phone bill in the air, as well as the exact amount of the bill.
$63?
Apparently, Blue wasn't completely free. You still had to dial up the information line, which cost 50 cents per call. I had made 126 information calls in 1 month. Blue boxing is similar to the concept of mind hacking. We're trying to log out of our usual user mode and log back in as super user to unlock special powers and features. We're trying to trace our mental system back to its roots, where we can alter the code that controls our life. Easy to understand, difficult to do. It's as if the mind, like an insecure IT overlord, wants to keep us locked in user mode. Even when we manage to get into super user mode temporarily, before we know it, we're locked out. We realize that somehow we've slipped back into regular user mode, caught up in the content of the mind again. We've slipped back into the movie. A fascinating study published in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience shows that practicing this super user mode can greatly improve our powers of cognitive control, or the ability to focus our mind, which is linked to success in school, work, and life. In the study, subjects were trained to focus on a specific target, to notice when their minds had wandered, then to return their attention back to the target. With practice, they were able to sustain attention and ignore distractions for progressively longer periods of time, actually rewiring their neural circuitry to be more efficient. You'll learn this technique shortly. Put another way, the test subjects practiced getting into superuser mode, noticing when they were logged out, then finding their way back to superuser mode. As you'll soon see, getting logged out of the system is not the problem. The problem is noticing that you've been logged out of the system. In other words, the trick is becoming conscious of when you're in control of the mind, superuser mode, and when you're lost in the mind, user mode. The takeaway is that with time and training, you can learn to stay in superuser mode for longer periods of time. More important, you can learn to interrupt the usual user mode so you can quickly switch into superuser mode with a quick Control M. If the mind movie idea doesn't appeal to you, think about getting super user access to your mind instead. Thinking versus meta-thinking. In junior high school, I was on the chess team. It was the only sport I could play without getting winded. My father taught me the basics of chess, and I joined the team understanding how all the pieces moved as well as the basic concept of the game. Our chess coach was also the school guidance counselor, giving him double geek credentials. I first met him during the summer, where he gave me a 30-page badly Xeroxed packet of chess strategy, all the openings, tactics, and endgames that you could use to win. I spent the summer squinting at this arcane document as scholars once studied the Dead Sea Scrolls, learning terms like en passant and Ruy Lopez. I gradually came to understand there was another level of playing chess, a higher level, where you focused on not just moving individual pieces to achieve the short-term objective of taking enemy pieces. Instead, you orchestrated the movement of all your pieces against your opponent's weaknesses in order to checkmate the king. What my chess coach taught me was meta-chess. He taught me how to work on my game, not just work in the game. Begin call-out. Work on your mind, not just in your mind. End call-out. Our modern word meta comes from the Greek preposition meta, which means after. Aristotle's Metaphysics was simply the book that came after physics. In the 20th century, the prefix evolved into a term meaning about its own category, or an X about X, For example, a meta-theorem is a theorem about theorems in general. We use this prefix all the time in modern technology, such as metadata, data that describes other data, or meta-tags, HTML tags that describe the content of the HTML page itself. We even use it as an adjective, saying, that's meta, to describe concepts such as Superman reading his own comic book, Gödel's incompleteness theorems, mathematical proof showing that mathematics can never be fully proven. Movies like The Grand Budapest Hotel, which is a movie about a girl reading a book written by an author who was told a story. TV shows that break the fourth wall, like the Doctor Who episode entitled The Mind Robber, in which the Doctor and his companions face the threat of becoming fictional characters. Meta-emotion, for example, being sad about being sad, or we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Meta-programming, or programs that write new code for themselves at runtime. A simple example is the JavaScript eval statement. A meta-joke, such as, a priest, a rabbi, and a minister walk into a bar. Bartender says, what is this, some kind of joke? Meta is, in fact, a sign of the times. We are gradually becoming capable, perhaps even evolving in our capability, of seeing things from the meta perspective. There's something transcendent and wonderful about this ability to analyze a thing from a higher level of abstraction, as if we are stepping into the next dimension. In mind hacking, we are not just thinking. We're meta-thinking, or thinking about our thinking. The technical term for this is metacognition. We are analyzing how our thoughts form, the sequence of thoughts that follow each other, how those thoughts drive our emotions and actions, and how they ultimately impact our lives. Thinking is good! Thinking is how we make decisions, get stuff done, and move our lives forward. It is right to spend most of our time in thinking mode, and too few people do even that. But meta-thinking is the critical skill to develop for mind hacking. Ultimately, we want to become proficient at moving between these two modes. Three models, one idea. So now we have three useful models: the mind movie, super user mode, and meta-thinking. These are three ways to think about one simple idea, viewing the mind objectively, not getting caught up in content. In other words, becoming aware of your own mind. As I was getting sober, I cannot remember a specific moment where I became aware of my mind. It was a dawning realization, a skill I gradually developed through the exercises in the following chapters. But as that awareness grew, so did a sense of freedom and excitement. I had identified so strongly with my mind that I believed everything it told me. Now I realized that I had a choice. At this point, you also have a choice. While you are certainly aware of your mind, the challenge in mind hacking is to increase your powers of awareness. From here on out, I encourage you to approach your mind with a spirit of openness and curiosity. Observe it. Imagine how it could be used differently. In other words, approach your mind like a hacker. Learning to develop this awareness to make it a habit is the foundation of mind hacking. As we learn to recognize what is the mind and what is us, we can begin to observe how untamed the mind really is, as we'll see in the next chapter. 1.2. Your mind has a mind of its own. Our minds are like misbehaving dogs. When my wife and I were dating, she had a 50-pound German Shepherd that was, to put it politely, insane. The dog's name was Cassie, And while Cassie was supposedly purebred, she may have actually been inbred. We never asked questions about her family history. All we knew was that somehow Cassie's DNA double helix got wrapped around the central strand like a leash around a pole. Cassie was unpredictable, exhausting, and dangerous. When the doorbell rang, she would greet visitors by jumping on top of them full force, barking, slobbering uncontrollably, and sometimes biting them. At night, she would fall into a deep slumber underneath a coffee table, only to suddenly bolt upright at 3 o'clock a.m., overturning furniture and everything on it. Taking Cassie for a walk was a daily adventure. First, you'd have to get the leash on, chasing her through the house as she knocked over chairs and appliances. Once outside, you'd hang on for dear life as she lunged randomly at any object that caught her attention. Fire hydrants, balloons, invisible phantoms. She would slam her head into trees and occasionally try to attack children. If we had brought in the dog whisperer, he would have become the dog screamer. Eventually, Cassie was taken away to live on a farm. We thought she needed a little more room to run. Apparently, we were right, because as soon as her new owners let her off their truck, Cassie went bounding off into the sunset, barking wildly. They never saw her again. Our minds are like that dog, constantly chasing squirrels, mailmen, and passing cars. This is easily observed by simply trying to quiet your mind. Within a few minutes, your dog mind will leap up, run around in circles, and pee on the carpet. It doesn't want to sit still, and it doesn't want to obey your commands. What's more, the temptation to let the mind do this is incredibly overwhelming. "I'm going to sit quietly and keep my mind empty," you vow to yourself. After about 30 seconds of silence, your mind starts whimpering. "What did you eat for breakfast?" it asks you. "Cornflakes, right?" "I'm sitting quietly," you say, swatting at the dog mind with a rolled-up newspaper. "How do they make cornflakes anyway?" it barks. "Where's the corn?" In any other situation, this question would hold zero interest for you. But now it becomes a burning obsession. "How do they make cornflakes?" you find yourself asking. Then, "No, we are sitting still, dog mind." The mind settles down for a second, then jumps back up, barking louder. "There's a rooster on the front of the cornflakes box. What's that about?" That's when the dog takes off, with you running behind it on a leash. Before you realize what's happened, you've listed your top 10 favorite breakfast cereals, created a new recipe for bacon muffins, and mentally replayed a grade school argument about Pop-Tarts. It's as if our minds have been misbehaving for so long that we've tuned out the incessant barking and are content to live with the craziness. In fact, we seem to relish the craziness, to take comfort in the stream of thoughts. I can't emphasize enough how seductive and irresistible our thoughts can be, especially when we're trying not to get lost in them. It is incredibly easy to get caught up in the movie, and when we're caught up in it, we're not directing it. Now for the good news. Like dogs, our minds can be trained. And like a well-trained dog, our minds can go from a holy terror to man's best friend. If you've ever owned a well-behaved dog, you know the pleasure of having a faithful companion, an obedient helper, and a loyal pal. And your mind can be the same way. Sorry, cat people. Find your own analogy. Truly, your mind can be both your worst enemy and your best friend. The attention economy. Imagine that you wake up tomorrow in a parallel universe. Everything in this universe is the same except for one big difference. Money has been replaced by attention. All citizens have little meters attached to their heads right between the eyes that show where they've been spending their limited daily supply of attention. Let's say in this universe, a minute of your attention is worth a dollar. This means when you sit down and enjoy a couple of hours of TV, you're paying $120 for the privilege. Spending a few minutes, and you really are spending a few minutes, catching up with friends will cost you $10. When you drive down the interstate, you're leaking pennies and nickels whenever a billboard catches your eye. When your mind obsesses over some difficult relationship or unfortunate event, you pay $15 or $30 at a time. Over the course of a week, this adds up. You might spend a significant portion of your monthly attention on anxiety and guilt. In this universe, most citizens have no idea where all their attention goes. It just seems to get used up, and there's never enough to go around. Everyone, it seems, has attention deficit disorder. This is because there are hidden attention taxes everywhere you look. All kinds of messages, alerts, and interruptions that slowly drain your focus. Someone sends you a text message and you pay a quarter for the ensuing conversation. You spend hundreds of dollars a year sifting through unwanted email. You happily spend thousands of dollars watching advertisements on TV. Your attention is constantly being depleted without your knowledge. In this universe, instead of hiring a financial advisor, you hire an attention advisor. Looking at your forehead meter, he shows you how to stop the attention leaks and how to reduce your attention tax. Then he teaches you an incredibly valuable trick. When you focus your attention on attention itself, it's like putting money in a savings account with compounding interest. He cites the old proverb, "It takes attention to make attention," showing you how to invest attention to create even more of it. Now for the twist. Except for the forehead meter, you're in that universe right now. The idea of an attention economy, named by Babson College professor and management consultant Thomas H. Davenport, states that human attention, not money, is the scarce and valuable commodity. All those Super Bowl advertisers are paying for all that human attention. Times Square is such valuable real estate because it attracts so much attention. A tech company with millions of users can be worth billions of dollars even if it doesn't make a dime in profit because of its attention-generating power. Time is money, and your time, in the form of your attention, is your most valuable resource. The myth of multitasking. I know someone who multitasks during his one-hour commute to and from work each day. I don't mean he just sends text messages or checks his email. I mean he actually watches movies on his laptop while he's driving. Or he'll pull up the New York Times on his tablet and put it on the steering wheel so he can read while he drives. Sometimes he'll play games. He gets in a lot of accidents. Go to any technology conference and you'll notice that practically everyone is immersed in a screen, phone, tablet, laptop, paying little attention to what is actually going on. It's disconcerting to speak at these events because no one is looking at you. Everyone is listening with one ear, which seems worse than not listening at all. These are conferences that cost thousands of dollars to attend and people are barely paying attention. Or take a look in the conference rooms of companies across the world where there are dozens of employees supposedly engaged in the meeting but actually lost in their screens. If everyone is only giving the meeting one-tenth of their attention, it requires 10 people to make up the attention of one person. This is why so many inessential people are invited to the meeting. Hopefully someone is listening, someone who can make the critical decision. We pay an awful lot of attention tax through the digital distractions that tempt us every waking moment. Email, websites, instant messaging, social media, text messages, and funny photos of overweight babies. Who can resist all these things? And why would you want to when clearly they are put there for our enjoyment? Begin call out. Those who multitask are doing nothing fast. End call out. The torrent of information, as well as the technologies that feed it to us, are so new that we don't have rules for them yet. We indiscriminately install time-wasting apps, leave on concentration-interrupting alerts, and jump at text messages, emails, and friend requests. If our minds are already misbehaving dogs, then these technology toys are like squirrels in the front yard. The problem is not the technology, but our indiscriminate and undisciplined use of it. These attention-grabbing apps and alerts quickly become bad habits, making our minds even less disciplined. Just as we must watch our diet to avoid getting fat, we must watch our attention-interrupting habits so that our mental powers do not become weak and flabby. Among the worst of these habits is multitasking. There is a wealth of scientific research indicating that multitasking really means doing several things badly at once. Multiple studies have shown that you're slower when you switch between tasks than when you do one task repeatedly, and that you grow less and less efficient as the tasks grow increasingly complex. Psychiatrist Edward Hallowell defines multitasking as a, quote, mythical activity in which people believe they can perform two or more tasks simultaneously as effectively as one, unquote. And we continue to buy into the myth that multitasking is possible and even desirable. We keep open a chat window so we're always available. We jump at text messages. We keep a feed or news ticker running so we're plugged in or connected. Stanford University sociologist Clifford Nass, one of the pioneers of multitasking research, explained it like this. Quote, "People who multitask all the time can't filter out irrelevancy. They can't manage a working memory. They're chronically distracted. They're even terrible at multitasking. When we ask them to multitask, they're actually worse at it. So they're pretty much mental wrecks." Unquote. In other words, this fragmentation of attention is making our minds weaker, not stronger. Each distraction you allow yourself actually makes you less productive, less capable, and less squirrel! I'm sorry. Thought I saw a squirrel. We all have ADD. If multitasking is so bad for us, why do we keep at it? Because it is addictive. As you wait in line at a restaurant, do you pull out your phone? As you're getting ready for bed, do you check your email one last time? As you're sitting at a table with flesh and blood human beings, do you interact with humans somewhere else? It's this addictive nature of our devices that has led writer Soren Gordhammer to ask, are we in control of technology, or is technology controlling us? Begin mind game. Squirrel. For the rest of the day, try to become aware of whenever your attention is pulled away from the task at hand by either digital or human interruptions. Try to become aware of the feeling of broken flow when you lose your concentration. Keep track of how many interruptions you notice. At the end of the day, write down the final number on your practice sheet. End mind game. Is it any wonder attention deficit disorder is so prevalent? Although ADD was first described in 1902, it has been steadily on the rise in recent years. Now, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, nearly 10% of U.S. school-aged children, ages 4 to 17, have ADD, to say nothing of the adults. Here's an easy way to see the mind clearly. Occasionally, go into a meeting or social gathering without your device, and be aware of your impulse to check a screen. You may find screen checking has become an ingrained habit, a compulsion. And the only way to begin correcting this impulse, this addiction, is to first become aware of it. This need to constantly check a screen is a symptom of the misbehaving dog mind, as is the need to have several browser tabs open, to do homework while watching TV, or to simultaneously play three hands of online poker while flying a plane. Your mind craves information. That's what it eats. Unfortunately, your mind has bulimia. A 2013 study from Kent State University surveyed 500 students and found that higher smartphone use was highly correlated with higher anxiety. Stress and screens go hand in hand. Another study at the University of Worcester in Britain found the same holds true for workers. The more they check their smartphones, the more they suffer from stress. Quote, because people get caught up in compulsively checking for new messages, alerts, and updates. Unquote. The great Russian physiologist Ivan Pavlov trained dogs by always ringing a bell before he presented them with food. Eventually, he found the dogs would slobber uncontrollably as soon as he rang the bell, even before he had presented the food. Their bodies had become conditioned to prepare for food when the bell was rung. Similarly, attention-interrupting tools, like email alerts and instant messaging, have conditioned our minds to expect a tiny burst of informational pleasure. Let's say you get a text message alert. Maybe it even sounds like a bell. You know there is new information waiting for you. It might be someone saying hello. It might be a picture of your sister's kids. It might even be an exciting emergency. That bell has conditioned our dog minds to slobber with anticipation as we stop whatever we're doing and tend to the text message. We are all Pavlov's dogs. Try to become aware of the precise feeling so you can recognize it when it happens. Try to capture that feeling of discontinuity, the jerkiness of being pulled out of concentration. That drug-like cycle, the addictive temptation with its accompanying mini burst of pleasure, is what we want to overcome. The disobedient dog thrives on this chaos. It is a picture of mental weakness. Now compare this with the feeling of flow, being immersed in an activity with unbroken concentration. You might call this being in the zone or losing yourself. You can probably think of some activity where you're in the zone, making music, coding, or just reading a great book. Close your eyes and picture that flow of effortless concentration. Try to get a sense of what it feels like. That's what the well-trained mind is all about. This is a picture of mental strength. We can learn how to develop this state at will. The key to this retraining is the lost art of concentration, the subject of our next chapter. Concentration training brings clarity and focus to our mental efforts and is a foundational skill of mind hacking. It's not just about turning off your instant messenger, but also about learning specific exercises that actively increase your powers of concentration. This is how you discipline the dog. 1.3. Developing Jedi-like concentration. You probably remember the scene from the original Star Wars where Luke Skywalker is learning to use the Force on board the Millennium Falcon.
Remember, a Jedi can feel the Force flowing through him,
Obi-Wan Kenobi instructs him as the training droid shoots Skywalker on the leg. Haha, mocks Han Solo. Hokey religions and ancient weapons are no match for a good blaster at your side, kid.
You don't believe in the Force, do you? Luke asks him.
There's no mystical energy field that controls my destiny, Solo snorts. It's all a lot of simple tricks and nonsense.
I suggest you try it again, Luke.
Obi-Wan puts a helmet on Luke's head, blocking his vision. Concentrating, this time Luke blocks the lasers, relying entirely on his instincts. Solo never apologizes. Whether you're more like Obi-Wan Kenobi or Han Solo when it comes to believing in the Force, you certainly know the power of concentration. A moment's reflection will probably show you that your best work, strongest ideas, and deepest insights come from moments of concentration, when your mind is clear, calm, and focused. You may even long for these moments and wish that you had more time for them. In the sequel, The Empire Strikes Back, Luke goes off to train with Yoda, developing incredible powers of concentration. Now he is able to stand on one hand upside down while balancing Yoda and levitating rocks. Han Solo and his blaster, meanwhile, get frozen in carbonite. This chapter is your Jedi training. Reclaiming and retraining. The great psychologist William James once said that the skill of, quote, voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, and will. An education which should improve this faculty would be the education par excellence, unquote. I will lay out that education, par excellence, which is French for very good at golf. It may help to think of your attention in two ways. First, you have what is called voluntary or top-down attention, which is where you choose to direct your mind. Right now, it is focused on these words. We don't have a good vocabulary for attention, so the best analogy I can give you is the proton pack from Ghostbusters, the concentrated energy guns they use to capture ghosts. That stream of positively charged energy is like your voluntary attention. You can point it at this, and this, and this. Just please, don't cross the streams. You also have a reflexive or bottom-up attention, which is when something catches your attention. Though sometimes this is exceedingly useful, such as when we hear someone call our name in the middle of a noisy public square, it is also what we might call being distracted by shiny objects.
Metallic squirrel!
The great challenge of our time is to strengthen our top-down attention, our ability to concentrate, while weakening our reflexive attention, our tendency to become distracted. Therefore, developing your powers of concentration involves two components: reclaiming attention through reducing distractions, and retraining your mind through concentration exercises. Reclaiming attention involves taking an inventory of all the avoidable distractions that surround you, then reducing or eliminating them. These are lifestyle changes, usually small and incremental, that add up to a huge difference over time because they help keep you focused on a daily basis. Retraining your concentration involves a specific set of mind games that will help you not only calm the mind, but also harness its power. Your success with mind hacking will depend largely on how seriously you take these games and how deeply you integrate them into your lifestyle. Everything else builds on these games. They're your mental fundamentals. These are not just one-time lessons, but core life skills that will make you better at everything you do. If you're an entrepreneur or business person, these concentration games will give you an edge, a competitive advantage. If you're involved in a relationship or a parent of young children, they will bring you greater calm and mental clarity. They will bring you focus, poise, and confidence, and create a mental environment where you can train your mind to accomplish incredible achievements. The exercises in this chapter are meant to become habits. If you're learning how to live a healthy lifestyle, you don't just do a month of ab crunches and then call it quits. You integrate exercise and movement into your everyday life. Similarly, the more you can work these skills into your daily routine, the more powerful you will become at mind hacking. You may not learn how to levitate objects with your mind like Luke Skywalker, but you could very well develop a levitation technology, then license out the patent. Anything is possible. Reclaiming attention. The 16 people gathered at the DART Neuroscience Convention Center in San Diego have the best memories on the planet. These memory athletes, as they are known, are here to compete in head-to-head memory battles. They stare at computer screens that rapidly flash names, numbers, or words. The athletes memorize these random lists with amazing speed, then recall them with pinpoint accuracy. The annual Extreme Memory Tournament, or XMT, also a great name for a memory drug, offers $60,000 in prize money to the winners. My favorite competitor is Ola Kar Risa of Norway, who wears not only sound-canceling headphones that you might see on a flight runway, but a cap with a long visor and side flaps. His side flaps are hilarious, ensuring that no distractions enter his peripheral vision as he stares at the computer screen. He looks like a horse that's wearing blinders while landing a plane. But there's science behind this approach. As Henry L. Roediger III, one of the psychologists studying these memory athletes, tells the New York Times, quote, "We found that one of the biggest differences between memory athletes and the rest of us is in a cognitive ability that's not a direct measure of memory at all, but of attention," unquote. The fundamental skill these memory athletes have developed is known as attentional control, or the ability to choose what to pay attention to and what to ignore. We might also call this your ability to concentrate. Sometimes you'll say, "My attention was wandering," which is an excellent phrase that shows that you have something called an attention, which is sometimes under your control, but sometimes goes for a brief walk. This attention, this focus point of consciousness, is under continual assault, much of it by the environment you create for yourself. Some distractions cannot be avoided. If you work in an office, for example, your coworkers may be motorized disturbance makers. Unenlightened bosses may expect you to be available via chat 24 hours a day. Parents, especially new parents, may find it especially challenging to focus since young children are interruption machines. My wife gave a name to her bewildered, sleep-deprived mental state when our kids were small, mom brain. What we're targeting is the unnecessary distractions, the interruptions that we allow into our lives either out of habit, ignorance, or laziness. We are easy to distract and very bad at doing two or more things at the same time, says Columbia Law School professor Tim Wu. Yet our computers, supposedly our servants, constantly distract us and ask us to process multiple streams of information at the same time. It can make you wonder, just who is in charge here? Getting rid of these distractions will make you happier, since your mind sees digital distractions as unfinished tasks. Productivity guru David Allen, the best-selling author of Getting Things Done, warns of the mental clutter of unfinished tasks, and there's research to back up his claim. In the 1960s, Russian psychologist Bluma Zygarnik showed that starting any kind of task gives your mind a mild psychic anxiety until that task is complete. Unfinished tasks nag at you. Unwanted digital distractions add to that mental clutter. Each one reminds you there's another task needing your attention. Part of our Pavlovian response to jump at those notifications is the need to close that open task loop, to consider the project complete, no matter how trivial. Well, now I have to get my social media profile to 100%. Get rid of the notifications and you'll reduce your mental clutter and your anxiety. More important, you'll be able to focus on what's more important. Instant messaging. If you're in the habit of messaging frequently throughout the day, stop. Uninstall IM apps or set them to away by default. The problem with messaging is that distractions create more distractions. When you respond, another response comes back. In between, you're trying to get fragments of work done. It's a high interruption environment. Text messaging. Just like instant messaging, text messages distract our concentration over a longer period of time because of the slow pace of a conversation carried out over text. Few of us are willing to turn off text messaging on our phones, but you can set aside times of the day to respond to messages or wait until you're between tasks rather than answering immediately. Internet distractions. Whether it's checking your stock portfolio or updating your fantasy football team, we pay heavy attention tax on internet distractions. It's okay to allow yourself these distractions, but ideally as rewards for periods of focused concentration. By flipping the model on its head, using internet distractions as rewards for completing difficult work rather than avoiding it, you can greatly improve your concentration as well as your quality of work. Audible and visual notifications. App developers and software companies have a vested interest in getting you to use their products. Therefore, they have developed a wide array of attention-getting devices to remind you to check in. Icons, messages, notifications, beeps, boops, and ding-dong arugas. Like Pavlov's dogs, these train us to expect a quick hit of satisfaction whenever the bell rings. So turn off the bell. Get the icons out of your system tray. Turn off notifications. Ruthlessly uninstall. Media. Do you switch on the TV as soon as you enter the house? Do you turn on a podcast as soon as you get in the car? We are voracious consumers of media, binge viewing entire seasons of TV, watching sports games as we eat in restaurants, keeping one eye on the TV as we do our daily tasks. Instead of making media consumption your default activity with brief periods of silence, try to make silence your default activity with planned entertainment breaks of TV, radio, or movies. Silence is golden. Email. Eliminate! Filter! Unsubscribe! Do you really need the daily Doctor Who digest or the impassioned pleas to save the chickens in El Salvador? It's true that individual emails are easy to delete, but each mailing list you get off eliminates dozens of micro-distractions and deletions in the future. They add up. To begin, you're only investing an hour in cleaning up these distractions. Set a timer and stop when the hour is up. Don't fall into the ironic trap of wasting the next week trying to reclaim your time. You're not after perfection, just simplification. You can always continue to simplify later. In other words, simplification is a process. It's much better to start with an hour than set a recurring appointment in your calendar to review and eliminate further once a month. Keep it simple, Skywalker. Begin Mind Game, the 1 hour investment. Spend 1 hour cleaning out or turning off unnecessary digital distractions, including instant messaging, text messaging, notifications and alerts, time-wasting internet sites, unnecessary emails. Set a recurring appointment in your calendar for a monthly review to eliminate further. Count the number of digital distractions you turned off and record that number in your practice sheet. End Mind Game. Retraining your mind. Quote, if you just sit and observe, you will see how restless your mind is. If you try to calm it, it only makes it worse. But over time, it does calm. And when it does, there's room to hear more subtle things. You see so much more than you could see before. It's a discipline. You have to practice it. Unquote. Steve Jobs. The basic concentration game is simple. So simple, in fact, that you may be tempted to ignore or discount it. Some people call it meditation or mindfulness, but I prefer to call it concentration training, since that's what it is. Your mind hacking success rests largely with the seriousness and tenacity with which you approach this basic game. Like chess, it offers a lifelong challenge of mastery. Find a comfortable place to sit where it's reasonably quiet and you're free from distractions. Sit with your legs crossed or your feet on the ground. If you find yourself getting drowsy, stand. Close your eyes and focus on your breath. Relax each part of your body, starting from the top of your head, your forehead, eyes, cheeks, mouth, jaw, etc., down through your toes, then back up again. This should take 2 to 3 minutes. Mentally tell your mind what you're going to do. For example, for the next 20 minutes, I will focus on the breath so that I may develop superhuman concentration. Now, focus on the breath at the center of the nostrils. When you find yourself following your mind, lost in the movie, simply redirect it back to the breath at the nostrils. Score +1 point for noticing and calmly redirect back to your breath. Keep track of your points on your fingers or in your head. You can set a soft timer or alarm for 20 minutes, though eventually you will get a feel for when 20 minutes have passed. Remember to write down your final score, the number of times you caught your mind wandering, on your practice sheet. Make it your goal to practice faithfully, and you will see the benefits. Studies show this type of game will improve attention, regulate emotions, keep you healthier, make your relationships better, and even make you feel good. It's scientifically proven to nourish, revitalize, and refresh both you and your mind. How to make this a habit. Practicing for 20 minutes a day is a terrific goal. Just wake up half an hour earlier. If your schedule doesn't allow it, then do 15, 10, or even 5 minutes to start. The trick to succeeding over the long term is to make this concentration game a habit. As with getting your body in shape with regular physical exercise, getting your mind in shape requires developing a routine that integrates this exercise into your lifestyle. In his book, The Power of Habit, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Charles Duhigg proposes that we can more easily create new habits by bookending them with a cue to start the habit, as well as a reward once we've completed the habit. For example, if we're trying to create a habit of daily exercise, we might always set our running shoes by the bed as a visual cue upon waking, and always treat ourselves to a post-workout smoothie reward when finished. In order to turn the concentration game into a positive habit, then, you need to consciously set up a cue to begin, as well as a reward when complete. Here are some tips. Choose a consistent time. First thing in the morning is best before your to-do list kicks in. Make it a part of your day-starting routine, as I do, and be sure to practice at the same time. Choose a consistent place. Pick somewhere you will not be disturbed. This can be your bedroom or a spare room. I've been known to practice in my car before work, often while parked. Choose a consistent reminder. Keep this book by your bed or set out your favorite chair. You can also set a digital reminder, like a phone alert. Here's where alerts can be a useful thing. Choose a consistent reward. The first reward is logging your score into your practice sheet, creating a positive feedback loop. Adding in a second healthy reward locks in that motivation. A shower, or breakfast, or music. Be consistent in your cue and reward. As with training children or pets, continuing to enforce the same routine day after day will help the practice habit stick. Practice, not perfection. Avoid all-or-nothing thinking where you either stick to a perfect schedule or you don't practice at all. The important thing is to keep practicing. If you miss a few days, just pick it back up. Variations. There are many variations on the basic concentration game to keep it interesting, but my strong recommendation is to decide beforehand which variation you will play. The temptation will be to switch to a new variation mid-practice, which is a subtle trick your mind will play to amuse itself. Pick one and stick with it.